Our next speaker is a health policy analyst with the Center for American Progress. He's engaged with a broad range of government and community stakeholders to bring issues of health equity for LGBT to the forefront of our healthcare reform debate. His previous work with the National Coalition for LGBT Health, which is the nation's most respected voice for LGBT health issues and federal policymaking, gives him a wealth of experience to share with us to help bridge that gap between what we need to do and the structural interventions and policies that enable us to do it. Please help me in welcoming Kellen Baker to the podium.
Thank you, Mark, and thank you all for being here today. How's everybody doing? I know, long session after lunch, we know, but pretty soon we'll get to questions. But before we get there, I do want to talk a little bit about this dilemma that we find ourselves in with regard to LGBT health and health for MSM. The title of the presentation, Not Waving, But Drowning, notice the question mark, that actually comes from a poem by Stevie Smith. And the person who's narrating the poem is standing on a shore and seeing a person far out in the water and not able to tell, is that person waving or is that person drowning? And in a lot of ways, that's where we are in the field of LGBT health. We're not quite sure what the health of our community looks like sometimes, where our needs are, what exactly is going on. But what I want to do is talk quickly through some of the barriers that we do know exist, some of the systemic areas and ways that our systems fail us, fail our communities, fail our youth, fail us as adults, and make it hard for us to get the sexual health services, other health services that we need, and to live healthy and safe lives. So what this presentation is sort of ultimately about is how do we get to this point where we can take charge of our health and healthcare, understand some of the unique concerns and barriers that face MSM and LGBT populations, and figure out what health for us actually looks like and what LGBT inclusive health services and systems look like as well. Healthcare services for MSM or LGBT people. I know this is totally heretical at the STD conference, right? You all are at the bottom. Sorry. It's not hierarchical by intention, though it is intended to take the pyramid back up or trace a little bit further back up in the health system from talking specifically about HIV/AIDS care or sexual health services and talking instead about some of the other kinds of health services that these kinds of sexual health services need to be embedded in. Talking about prevention and wellness, talking about primary health services and other basic health care services, talking about mental and behavioral health services, and how all of these fit together with making MSM, making LGBT people able to access the care that they need when they need it. Unfortunately, as most of us in this room, probably all of us, know all too well, either from our experiences with populations that aren't being served or because of our own experiences trying to access health care in a system that really isn't set up to deliver it in a lot of ways, there are a lot of barriers to health care. I'm going to go through each of these in turn just to talk quickly about, again, what is the situation that we're dealing with? What are some of the basic parameters that we know about the situation of LGBT people and MSM in this country? And I hope that that will help take us to a place where we can actually assess waving, drowning, or perhaps swimming upstream. The first kind of barriers we call psychological, right? These are the things that go on for each of us in our everyday lives that separate us from the care that we need. Sometimes it's because we don't identify as MSM. There is no such thing as an MSM community, actually. If you think about it, that was the purpose of the MSM frame, right? Is there an LGBT community? A lot of us would argue yes. A lot of us would argue, though, that there are LGBT communities, many of them, and that it's impossible to say who is MSM, who is LGBT, who is queer, who is questioning, who's confused, who needs what? That is one of the first major barriers that people have to overcome when trying to figure out how to get the health services that they need. Misinformation. We've all heard a lot of lies told about our LGBT community, a lot of stories told about us that don't actually reflect who we are or what we need, a lot of people out there who don't have the best interests for us in mind when they're putting out information that's supposed to help keep us healthy and safe. Feelings of invincibility. I'm no longer a young invincible. Does anybody know what a young invincible is? Anybody in here a young invincible? Come on, under 26ers. There we go. All right, yes. The young invincibles, that's the term for those people who don't buy health insurance because they don't think they need it. Because they're 24, 25, feeling pretty sexy, feeling pretty good. I know you all, you're all, you know, not just feeling, it's definitely true. Definitely true. But those feelings of invincibility can be great because they can power us through our days, they can power us into careers, they can power us through into meaningful relationships with people who are important in our lives. But they can also tell us, with that little voice in the back of your mind that says, ah, you don't need to take care of yourself, it's fine. Don't worry about it. It'll all be fine tomorrow. I'll just do this just for one night. I don't really have to think about the consequences because I can't really imagine what the future looks like. Stigma and discrimination, obviously. We've heard quite a lot about minority stress, about the anxiety, the negative health consequences that are associated with the stigma and discrimination, those words that can kill too, that tell us, that tell our youth, that tell our elders, that we sometimes tell each other or ourselves, that we're not worth it, that we don't need to worry about getting healthcare services, and anyway, who cares? Physical barriers. This is one of the easiest to understand, I think. Lack of accessible facilities, whether that means geographically far away, whether that means you have a disability and you can't get there, whether that means that the facility is closing. If you see there the sign, help keep our doors open, asking for a $10 donation to try to keep this free health clinic in Kansas open. Even when our health systems, our health facilities are open, are there accessible services there? Does the community health center down the road actually have the services that we need? Can we get the tests that we need? Can we get the screenings? Can we get the medication prescribed that we actually need? If we're transgender, can we find a healthcare facility that will prescribe hormones or that will link us up with mental health providers? That's not always a given, particularly in a time of such short budgets, as everybody in this room knows, where healthcare centers and other facilities are struggling every day to keep their doors open and the lights on. That's obviously related to financial barriers, which are both, as I say, the crunch in the U.S. health system right now that's saying we want health care and a lot of it, but we don't know how to pay for it. But it also operates on the individual level. Un and underemployment. Poverty. Low incomes, low-paying jobs, jobs that don't offer us health insurance. With the cost of medical care in this country going through the roof, if we don't have health insurance, there's a pretty good guarantee that we will not be able to get all of the care that we need. And even if we do have health insurance, 75% of the bankruptcies in this country come from medical bills. And the majority of those people were insured when they got sick. Finally, cultural barriers. And this is one that we've addressed already a lot today, so I'm just going to touch on it briefly. But lack of provider understanding of MSM diversity, the diversity of the LGBT community. If you can see there, it says, I'm not gay, but I sometimes have sex with other guys. People don't understand. That could be me. I'm not gay. I'm actually transgender. I have a female fiance. Not going to talk about what I do late at night. Y'all just pass me your business card. It's going to be fine. If I walk into a health clinic, maybe somebody will pick me out as MSM. Maybe somebody will pick me out as LGB or T. Probably not, though, because providers don't always know what they're looking for. Our healthcare clinics don't always know what they're looking for. They don't understand how diverse the MSM population is, how diverse the LGBT population is. that it can encompass people who look like me, people who look completely different from me, and probably, frankly, most of the people who actually are in our community look nothing like what your typical provider is looking for when they think, aha, that person's gay. Right? Because that's one of the biggest disparities, as Darrell was talking about, and Stephen as well, one of the biggest disparities is actually the disparity of representation. That we do not have the models out there in the media, out there for us all to see, out there for our young people to see, that show just how diverse our community really is. So how can we help our providers actually figure out whether the person who's sitting in their clinic, in their exam room, is actually part of our community and what kinds of services that person might need? A second cultural barrier, and this is obviously closely correlated with the first one, is a lack of provider cultural competence. This has come up, again, multiple times already today. A lack of provider cultural competence in working with MSM or LGBT people. Our providers don't always know. Sometimes they don't know they don't know. Sometimes they don't care. But whatever it is, for whatever reason, if your provider cannot tell that you are LGBT, does not care, or does not want to provide you with the services that you need, that is perhaps the most intractable barrier of all. Because you finally made it to the exam room, you've overcome all those other barriers, you're sitting there, you know you need services, you need that test, you need those hormones, whatever it may be. But if your provider isn't prepared to give it to you, how many other options do you have? For all too many of the people in our community, the answer is not many or none. That image there, though, I don't know if you all can read it. It's called Advancing Effective Communication, Cultural Competence, and Patient and Family-Centered Care for the Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Community. It's a resource that was put out last November by the Joint Commission, which is a non-governmental body, thank you very much, that oversees the certification and accreditation of the vast majority of healthcare facilities in the United States. Last year, the Joint Commission put out non-discrimination standards for all of the facilities it accredits that require them to be non-discriminatory on the basis of, among others, sexual orientation and gender identity. The Joint Commission then went ahead and went the extra mile and actually put out a monograph, this report, that aims to show facilities how they can deal with the barriers that they have identified, the barriers that they don't know about but that definitely exist, that are keeping the LGBT people in their patient population from getting the care that they need. And that's actually where our presentation is going to go now, to talk a little bit more about some of those resources, reports, policy activities, opportunities that are opening up for us to overcome these barriers, for us to break down these systemic obstacles that are keeping LGBT people from getting the care that they need. Because I'm in D.C., I'm obligated to say this. If I start speaking in acronyms, just start waving and I'll understand you're drowning. It's fine. We're terrible inside the Beltway. But the first couple of those that I just want to run through quickly before handing it over to Bill is the Affordable Care Act, which, contrary to popular belief, has not been repealed. There's... Right, thank you, thank you. The Affordable Care Act is out there. There are rules, regulations, activities happening under it all the time. And there are enormous opportunities in the Affordable Care Act for us to figure out how to address these systemic barriers. One of the biggest coming out from the Affordable Care Act is data collection. The Department of Health and Human Services is now trying to figure out how to collect routine and comprehensive data on sexual orientation and gender identity. The second, the National HIV/AIDS Strategy. The third, Healthy People 2020, to go back to Mark's formulation of 2020, right? Clear vision and equity. Healthy People 2020 was released in December of 2010. It's the federal government's blueprint for the decade between 2010 and 2020 to take us to where we need to be in 2020. And for the first time, Healthy People has an entire LGBT health topic area. So not only does it have a topic area about sexual health, not only does it have a topic area about young people, elders, access to care issues. It has an entire topic area that draws those together from a specifically LGBT focus. Finally, the National Prevention Strategy, and actually there are a number of strategies that have come out under the Affordable Care Act, many of which directly address HIV and AIDS, other sexual health issues, and all of these systemic barriers to care that are keeping LGBT people from being as healthy as we could be. So I really recommend that you all go to healthcare.gov, which can point out some of those strategies, and take a look at them. There's a lot in there that we can be using to frame our message not only as barriers and disparity, but as progress and equity. So keep your pants off. You know the saying, keep your pants on, hold, just calm down, right? But in this case, keep your pants off, keep having fun, keep doing whatever you're doing. But don't just wait quietly. Don't wait for somebody else to tear down those barriers or to fix those problems. Because there are a lot of tools that we have, actually, for starting to address so many of these barriers and actually connecting LGBT people with the care, with the healthcare services that they need. So I would say, keep swimming, because we've got a lot of life preservers and even a couple of water wings. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Kellen. I just love that. Our final speaker this afternoon probably needs very little introduction to this particular audience. As National Director for the National Coalition for STD Directors, Bill has been deeply involved in issues related to STDs and health equity, and I'm sure many of you have already had an opportunity, as I have, to get to know his passion for this work. Prior to taking the helm at NCSD, Bill was Vice President for Public Policy at the Sexuality Information and Education Council of the U.S., or CECUS, and spearheaded efforts nationally to end abstinence-only till marriage education programs in the United States. With NCSD, Bill has been a tireless partner to the division, as well as an outstanding advocate for sexual health equity, as well as an advocate for our STD programs around the country. So please help me welcome Bill to the podium.
Okay, two things up front. I'm going to keep my pants on until I'm done. Is that all right? And number two, I didn't do slides. What Mark's asked me to do is just to provide some concluding remarks and to talk a little bit about what NCSD is doing in the area of MSM sexual health. And then I do, we've got about a half hour from this point to do Q&A, and I want to make sure that we've got ample time for that. But I'd be remiss if I didn't do a couple props first, which is I really want to thank Mark and his leadership for spearheading and putting together this great panel. I am rather certain, because I was supposed to help him, and I was really not very much help, that this would not have happened if Mark hadn't really been on the case and pulled it together. I also just want to say I'm really glad to be with these gentlemen up here. I'm having that professional moment where I feel like the old guy, which is freaking me out. But it feels good. And then let me also, I want to give some acknowledgments as well to the Division of STD Prevention, both for the work that they're doing generally, but for prioritizing MSM as a priority population for the efforts going forward from the division. I think it's a major advance that helps not just put, yeah, absolutely, give props. And, you know, I think all of us are going to really look forward to working with DSTDP on what those activities flow from in prioritizing MSM sexual health. And then I also, you brought it up, I also want to acknowledge that the Division of Adolescent and School Health, whose director is sitting in the back of the room, Hal Wexler, who's just been a tireless champion, not just of adolescents, but of MSM, and for the first time ever, DASH is funding national NGOs like GLSEN to do MSM work, and it's absolutely incredible. And then finally, since DASH has moved into the national, I never get this right when I actually say it, so when it moves into NCHHSTP, it took me 2 years to say that, so I'm not even going to try and say what it stands for, into the National Center that Dr. Fenton runs. How's that? Now that Dash is there, that DHAP is clearly focusing on MSM, that DSTDP is as well, I think we have a tremendous opportunity, and perhaps we'll have to prod just a little bit to figure out what the coordination of MSM activities looks like across all of the divisions to make sure that all of those resources are being leveraged well. So let me talk a little bit about, I was going to talk a little bit, but we don't have time, about all of the really amazing innovative stuff that's happening across the country in NCSD's member health departments when it comes to MSM sexual health. There's been a lot of presentations here, and the expertise that we learn at NCSD really comes from the health department members that we're so proud to represent and that we learn from daily. What I would say on that is in the coming year, under a project on which we're working, we will be putting together a compendium of MSM sexual health initiatives that are being undertaken, both clinical and behavioral, on the part of health departments so that we can share those more widely with other health departments as we continue to scale up the role of health departments in MSM sexual health. But let me tell you a little bit about what MSM, what NCSD is doing generally. First, we have had a really significant and robust, and I think it's apparent in all of our materials, focus on issues of HIV and STD co-infection. And obviously you've heard some about that this morning. Now, before I came to NCSD, I was primarily sort of involved in HIV/AIDS advocacy. I served as a co-chair of the Federal AIDS Policy Partnership for a number of years. I'm still in the convening council for that, or the convening group for that. I helped lots of partners when we were trying to get the federal government to develop a national HIV/AIDS strategy. And I couldn't figure out why, when I got to NCSD, people weren't continuing to talk about HIV being an STD. And HIV is still an STD. So what we've really focused on at NCSD is talking like that, because it's purposeful to try and bring down the barriers that have persisted for too long between both programs and money and clinical delivery of services, but also to really focus much, much more on these issues of co-infection. And when it comes to MSM, in particular, issues of co-infection with chlamydia and gonorrhea and syphilis. We think this is a tremendous selling point, frankly, when we talk about HIV, and there's lots of political reasons to do that. The first is they have a lot more money than STD does. They also have a lot more support in Washington. There's no office for STDs in the White House. There is an office for HIV and AIDS. So how do we get them to carry our water and to understand that STD prevention is HIV prevention so that we're all working together? And we've really focused a lot on that in the last 2 years, and I'm proud of the work that we've accomplished there because I think we're making some tremendous difference. But there's obviously this real purpose as well, which is that we have alarming rates of co-infection. I'm not going to go too far into that because you've heard a lot about that this morning. I'm going to talk a little bit more about some of the clinical stuff that is important for NCSD and our members, I think, going forward. But the other thing that we've learned from this HIV work, and I want to give a lot of credit to NCSD's colleague partner, the National Alliance of State and Territorial AIDS Directors, or NASDAD. NASDAD represents the HIV directors in the state health departments, much like I represent the STD directors in the state health departments. And NASDAD, about a year and a half ago, came to us and said, we would like you to do a call to action on MSM sexual health in a way that would call our members and other public sector partners to address the unique needs of MSM sexual health because of alarming rates of increases among MSM, particularly young MSM of color, as has been said before, of HIV and also syphilis. So we worked with NASDAD. NASDAD and NCSD released that call to action, and it was catalytic in many ways. I can't go into all of it, but what I will say is I was particularly pleased that it was catalytic in getting funders and foundations invested in funding both of our organizations to do work. So together, the MacAIDS Foundation, if you all don't have your Viva Glam lipstick, even if you're a guy, go buy some. If you don't know about MacAIDS, they're a generous donor to organizations like NCSD and others. Through the sale of Viva Glam, sorry I had to do the promo because it's an amazing organization, came to us and said, we really want to fund you both to work on public sector issues when it comes to stigma and discrimination when it comes to MSM. And I was pleased because I had, when I first came to NCSD, there was another HIV/AIDS organization that found out I was talking to an HIV foundation and said, well, Bill, you know they're an HIV donor, as if I ought not be talking to them. So I just point that out because it shows also that MacAIDS thinks bigger and more thoughtfully, I think, than too many people, that a lot of people do not. So MacAIDS came to us and they said, yeah, we want to fund you guys to do this. So what we proposed was a series of activities, and I want to talk to you about what's coming down the pike. So the first thing we did with that money was we hired a health equity fellow at NCSD. His name's Justin Hill. I hope some of you have met him. He did a great poster presentation on some of this funded work. And Justin's job at NCSD is just to work on MSM sexual health. So we created a brand new position at a national organization for the sole purpose of working on MSM sexual health, and in particular at this critical intersection between HIV and STD prevention. The second piece that we've done is we launched an unprecedented landmark study of stigma and discrimination within public health practice when it comes to MSM, and in particular MSM of color. We released that survey in December. We had just over 1,300 responses. We're told that we have a really nice representative sample. I've seen some of the initial data. It's going to be released at the end of this month. We're doing a blue ribbon panel with a very prominent group of Latino and African American doctors who have primarily young MSM of color patients, you know, those trusted docs, to help us walk through that data, and we'll be releasing it. But of course, I'm not a huge fan of, I'm a policy person, so studies are great, but studies are only great if they're operationalized. So in year two of MacAIDS money, which we're thrilled that we heard that we got last week, we'll be operationalizing that and creating some programmatic direction around how health departments and other partners in the public sector can help reduce the amount of stigma and discrimination that creates a lot of the barriers to MSM sexual health that Kellen and others have talked about. And we're really excited about that. I don't get terribly excited about surveys and studies like that, but I think this one's going to be really cool. The third piece that we're working on that will be released later this year is what we're calling optimal care checklists. It is pretty clear, and a number of my colleagues have described this, that MSM are not getting the sexual health care that they need, and providers are not giving it to them and not figuring out a way to get it done. So what we have done is created sort of complementary materials that are meant to pre-bridge the conversation between provider and patient, so that there's no surprises when your doctor says, I want to give you a rectal swab for gonorrhea, right? There's no surprises when that question comes because the patient has already read through those materials in the waiting room. And we're very excited about both of these, the patient guide, the patient piece of material, and the provider guide, and we're going to make those widely available for free to both NCSD and NASDAQ member health departments for their own use and for the dissemination within their jurisdictions to private providers and other community health centers and providers. So we're really very, very excited about that. So let me close by just mentioning sort of, I think, a couple of other pieces that are really important, and some of this I tend to push the CDC on. One of the things that about being an advocacy organization is I don't always have to, you know, I can push the envelope a bit. So the first is, and Kellen talked about this, which is, I don't mean to blame providers, but providers are not doing a good job. Not only do they not know that their patient may be an MSM, but they're completely either unwilling or incapable of doing a sexual health history. 20 years ago, I remember working with my colleague Kaya Lewis, who's now the senior director to Secretary Sebelius, on a sexual health history for reproductive health care providers. And I don't think we've made very much progress since. And let me tell you why I feel that way. So when I moved to D.C. some time ago, just after graduate school, you know, it's a city, but it's a pretty tight gay community, and there were a couple gay docs. I don't know if the docs are gay, but all the gay guys like me went to those docs if you had private insurance. You went to those docs because they were the trusted ones. They had been seeing HIV patients forever. You knew you weren't going to be stigmatized about, about the behaviors that you were having, et cetera. So he's been my doc for as long as I can remember. But he also knows what I do for a living, right? So I go in and I tell him, here's what I need. Do these things this time. But then another younger friend of mine had moved to Washington. I said, I've got a great doc you should go see. Now, this is a guy who saw HIV/AIDS patients in the 80s and went through all of that, okay? This young guy went to this doctor. No sexual health history was taken. No questions were asked about whether he was MSM. But they did hook him up to an in-office EKG, which ticked me off because they did that because it's reimbursable. I had a discussion with the doctor afterward, by the way. But they didn't ask that guy all the questions they were supposed to ask him. So I set that out there because we tend to think that our challenge with providers is the new array of providers that are going to be seeing supposedly more patients, particularly male patients, under the Affordable Care Act and the expansion of Medicaid with health care reform. And I hate this expression, but you know how they say you're preaching to the choir? The choir needs preaching to. If you have docs who went through HIV/AIDS and are seeing primarily MSM patients, the dark days of HIV/AIDS, primarily seeing MSM patients, and they're not doing a sexual health history for new clients, are you kidding me? We have tremendous amount of work to do in this. And I know that this is not groundbreaking work, guys. Again, I was doing this, 20 years ago with OBGYNs. But it remains as important or even more important then, and particularly when it comes to MSM sexual health, we must scale up those activities. And I think it's a primary role that health departments might be able to play going forward. The other piece, which is very particular, I think, to my member health departments, although the expansion of this may go to community-based providers in an increasing way with the implementation of healthcare reform, is internet partner services. Now, let me say that I've been working in sexual and reproductive health for a long time, and I had no idea what IPS was before I got to NCSD. What I've come to realize, however, is that Internet Partner Services is a critically important component, particularly when it comes to MSM sexual health, because of the sex-seeking websites that MSM use, such as Adam for Adam, Manhunt, and increasingly Grindr. I am thrilled that DSTDP most recently has picked up a greater responsibility for providing technical assistance to member health departments to do internet partner services to those people who are in particular meeting sex partners on websites, but it has to be scaled up significantly. And moreover, we need to do a better work in working with those sex-seeking websites to ease the access that our member health departments have and accessing partners met on those websites for sex. For example, there is no identifying information in Grindr. So if someone had sex with someone, if an MSM had sex with someone they met on Grindr, there is no way to go back and find that person unless they happen to be in your same vicinity and their pic pops up. And your patient is beside you saying, that's the one, right? We have to be negotiating with these new technologies as they come along to make sure that we are able to continue to break the cycle of transmission, particularly when it comes to MSM sexual health, particularly when it comes to MSM, particularly when it comes to syphilis. Another piece that I think is critically important to underscore is the import of increasingly co-location of services delivery for MSM. And I had an experience last summer, so I go to New Mexico every summer because I teach at the University of New Mexico in the summer. And I had an experience where we went to a gay pride event, I think it was in Santa Fe last year, and the tent was set up for rapid HIV, right? Chock full of customers. We want that. Right? We want that. But then the syphilis draws and the hepatitis B vaccinations were being provided far away from that tent in a location far away. There were lots of reasons why that happened. Most of it was geographic. They couldn't get that particular vehicle up. There's lots of reasons why that happened. But in particular with the advent of a rapid syphilis test, which is FDA approved and not CLIA waived yet, we have to be co-locating things like a rapid syphilis test along with a rapid HIV test, particularly for MSM sexual health. I know the evidence isn't there yet, but this is a rights-based issue for me. And I will be excited to see when the evidence comes, but we shouldn't let the perfect be the enemy of the good here. MSM deserve rapid, quick assessment for syphilis testing. It ought to be done side by side with HIV. So let me just conclude with this. Those were some provocative things I said, and I know I'm going to catch hell from some CDC folks later, I'm sure. I think what's most important, and you all have heard me say this before, which is that the Affordable Care Act, depending on the day, either scares the hell out of me or I feel incredibly optimistic. What I do know, and Kellen raised this, and so did some of our other speakers, is that if we don't engage the opportunities that the Affordable Care Act sets out for us, along with all of these other anchors that Kellen talked about in Healthy People 2010 and the National HIV/AIDS Strategy, if we don't use these opportunities to push and secure better sexual health for MSM, we will have missed out on an incredibly valuable opportunity, and I think we all have a responsibility to make sure that we're engaging on that front. So thank you, and I'll turn it over to Mark for questions.